I'm going to start this afternoon's talk with a little language lesson. I've written up three words behind me, and I've broken them down into their syllables. We have a, sang, kata, which is what we translate as the unconditioned. A, it's what's called a privative, in other words, a negation, not. Sang means like together. Kata means literally made or done. It's from the same root as the word karma, to do. So asang kata means not made together, not put together. And we translate that as unconditioned, unfabricated, in some of the translations, uncompounded. But literally, it's not made together. Take out the privative A, and we get sankata, which means done or made together, put together, usually translated as the conditioned. And then another word, sankara, which is again exactly the same root, but it means, kara is the active form, which means that which puts together. Now, sankara, I'm sure some of you already recognize this word, it's usually translated as mental formations, the fourth of the five aggregates. Now, of course, as soon as you do that, you lose any sense of connection with asankata, sankata, sankara. I mean, this really is, I think, one of the reasons why it's very useful to learn these classical languages, because the English translations will introduce words and ideas that might be accurate at one level, but you lose the intimate connections that these different words play off one against the other. Well, that which does the putting together, that's why it's so difficult to translate. We don't have a word in English that does that. So sankara is that which does the putting together. And I find that by translating it as formation, you miss that altogether, because formation, a formation is something that's already put together, right? Whereas, and I noticed this when I was studying as a Tibetan Buddhist monk. It's exactly the same. The Tibetans were very literal in their translations. This would mean du ma je, du je, and du je. Du je being active, putting together, sankara. Du je, it's a different spelling, means that which has been put together. And du ma je, that which has not been put together. So if you're a Tibetan monk, you'll know immediately that these words are intimately connected. The unconditioned, the conditioned, and mental formations, you miss that totally. But I think that's really rather problematic. Sometimes they translate it as volitional formations. Okay, have I got something better? Not really, actually. I don't have a word in English that is an improvement on that at one level. My own choice would be inclinations. Sankara are inclinations. They're what move us to do something. If you think of the five so-called aggregates or bundles, you have the material conditions, the material world, rupa. Then you have vedana, the feeling tone or the emotional tone of experience. You have sanya, which literally means the knowing together, which we translate as perception. But again, it's a similar structure as this words. And then mental formations, or I would say inclinations. Inclinations are important because they are that element of our experience in which we incline to do something. In other words, it's the dynamic part of our experience as a human being. So when we're sitting in meditation, we're aware of the body, we're aware of the sounds, and maybe some visual imagery, that's rupa, that feels a certain way, it feels agreeable, disagreeable, that's vedana. It makes sense to us, we recognize it as a pain in the knee or an anxiety in the mind. In other words, experience is intelligible and coherent. It means when I look out there, I see windows and walls and lights and people. I don't just see blobs of color and shape. That's sanya, perception, as we translate it. And on the basis of that, I incline to respond. There's an inclination, if it feels good, I want to somehow have more of it or possess it or get it. If it's unpleasant, I want to get rid of it or I shy away from it. So all of these core key Buddhist ideas are tightly interconnected. And it's only really when you go to the root languages that you can really see these connections. Now this is important, I think, in what I want to look at this afternoon, which I think if we're going to understand asankata, the unconditioned with a capital U, in this translation, it's helpful to have this little bit of basic information. Okay, now, of course, I think a question that many of you might have asked is, well, what does the Buddha have to say about the unconditioned in other texts? I mean, surely the first, if we want to know what he means by the unconditioned, rather than just assuming that it means what it says, a state in which there is something is unconditioned, and as Morris Walsh and others read it, they just assume it means something like the absolute or the transcendent or God or something. Why not go back into the Pali Canon and find those passages where perhaps the Buddha explains what he means? Well, we're very lucky. We have a text called the Asankata Sangyutta. Now, the Sangyutta means same word sang, and yutta, yukta in Sanskrit, means joined together. So the Sangyutta Nikaya are those body of discourses that are joined together by theme. It's called the Sangyutta Nikaya. It's one of the five Nikayas in the Pali Canon. Now there's a section in that volume, it's all translated into English, called the Asankata Sangyutta, the connected discourses on the unconditioned. Well, this would seem to be the first port of call. Hopefully the Buddha's going to tell us what he means by the unconditioned. And happily he does. Problem solved. Okay, this is what he says. He says, monks, I will teach you the unconditioned and the path leading to the unconditioned. And what, monks, is the unconditioned? Or literally, what, monks, is unconditioned? An ending of desire, an ending of hatred, an ending of delusion. That is unconditioned. And what, monks, is the path leading to the unconditioned? Mindfulness directed to the body. This is called the path leading to the unconditioned. Now, I don't know about you, but when I first read that, I thought, well, this is strange. This is not what I expected. And what, monks, is asankata, the unconditioned, raga kayo, dosa kayo, moha kayo. an ending or the ending, again, a, the, could be either. An ending of desire, ending of hatred, ending of delusion. That is asankhata. Now here I think we have a clue that will help us understand what this is all about. Because the unconditioned is not just some, the unconditioned, certainly not with a capital U, some kind of transcendent state, but it is experience which is not conditioned by greed or hatred or delusion. So rather than describing some sort of transcendent state, which is beyond this conditioned world that is suggested in this translation, escape from the conditioned, escape from the born. The Buddha understands asankhata to mean when you are not conditioned by greed, hatred, and delusion. And greed, hatred, and delusion are three sankharas. Okay? And in terms of the Buddhist analysis of experience, these three, greed, hatred, delusion, are three conditioning forces, if you want, for sankhara, or inclinations that cause us a great deal of trouble and grief and prevent us, crucially, from experiencing a quality of life that is not determined by them and allows us to enter the path. Now, this is what we'll come back to tomorrow, so I'm not going to go into that too much now. But to understand here that what the Buddha is probably up to is a play on words. And this is quite a common feature of the Buddha's strategy. He takes ideas and terms that are probably well known in his culture, and he gives them a radically new meaning. I think it's quite possible, although there's no hard evidence for this, I think it's quite possible that asankhata, the unconditioned, meant at the Buddha's time, particularly in the Brahmanic or Upanishadic tradition, it did refer to Brahman, to God. The Buddha takes the same word and turns a noun into a verb. In other words, he's not rejecting that terminology, but he's giving it a totally new meaning. He does the same with a lot of terms like karma, or karma, action, arya, noble, and so on. So, in this text here, unconditioned is only intelligible when we specify what it is that we are no longer conditioned by. This is also a feature of the Buddha's teaching. He's very aware of the relational nature of language. And he does not slip into the habit of reification. In other words, privileging certain terms and giving them a quasi-absolute meaning. So when he talks of freedom, for example, it's not freedom with a capital F, but it's freedom from something and freedom to be able to do something else. Unconditioned means to be unconditioned by greed and hatred and delusion in order that we can live in a way that's not determined by those self-indulgent, neurotic, compulsive and instinctive forces that are so much part of our makeup. Now, asankhata is defined as an ending of desire, an ending of hatred, an ending of delusion, and that exact same phrase is used to define a number of synonyms of asankhata, and they are nibbana. Nirvana is also defined as an ending of greed, an ending of hatred, an ending of delusion. Amata, the deathless, is also defined as an ending of hatred, an ending of delusion, and an ending of desire. And also, curiously, the phrase parinya means to fully know something. And fully knowing is the term the Buddha uses as the way he describes how we relate to suffering. Suffering, he says, is to be fully known. The first noble truth is to be fully known, parinya. And he defines parinya as an ending of greed, an ending of hatred, an ending of delusion. So all of these terms are synonyms. So when the Buddha is talking about an unborn, an unbecome, an unmade, an unconditioned, he's talking about nibbana. He's talking about the deathless. He's talking about the unconditioned. And he's talking about fully knowing suffering. Now this is quite difficult to sort of fully get a grasp on. It's not obvious what's being said here. What does it mean? Why is fully knowing suffering considered to be the same thing as unconditioned and nibbana? Well, I think it's because the Buddha's suggesting that if we are to really embrace the condition we are in, this conditioned experience, we need to do so without the inclinations of attachment or greed or hatred or confusion. It's only when those elements, those drives, those habits are somehow suspended, at least, that we can have a kind of radiant and equanimous relationship to our experience here and now. So again, we're not talking, in that case, about something that is an escape from or a deliverance from the conditioned world. We're actually talking about a total embrace of the conditioned world. And I would say it's the same with nibbana. Nirvana, again, is one of these words that's often elevated to some almost impossibly high state of spiritual or mystical experience, but it's quite clear from here that nibbana is just that experience that's open to all of us, in which we're no longer determined in our thoughts or our words or our deeds by greed or hatred or delusion. It might last just a few moments. And it may be something that in a period of meditation we settle into a deep state of stillness and clarity, in which we know for ourselves that we are not bound to follow or get caught up in the inclinations of attachment and hatred. And that's freedom. And it's a freedom that's available in a way in each moment. This, I think, is where the Zen tradition is so helpful, because it recognizes that awakening is something that's a possibility here and now, this sudden enlightenment, they call it. But that, I don't think, is a peculiarly Zen idea. I think it's right here in the very core of the early teachings. Now, we could discuss later how come we kind of lost sight of that. How come nibbana and the unconditioned became metaphors for something beyond the world? But experientially, asankata simply means, well, it's simple, but it's not easy. It simply means a condition of being in this world unconditioned by greed and hatred and delusion.
Impossible at every moment.
Yeah. Well, it's as soon as this is for me why this is what we're doing when we sit, when we practice vipassana or mindfulness or Zen or whatever we call it. We're basically getting in touch with our innermost experience. We're cultivating a deep intimacy in a still, focused state of mind that we can cultivate and deepen. We can get very, very concentrated through practice. We can be very still and alert and aware. We can notice what's going on in such a way that we are free when a particular impulse emerges to simply see it as an impulse emerging, rather than getting carried away off into an anxiety or a plan or a grudge bearing or whatever it might be. Yes.
What did you mean by calling it or saying that it involves an embrace of the conditioned
world? Well, come back. You coming tomorrow? Yeah, okay, good. Embrace of the. For me, the first noble truth, so called, is about a learning how to embrace totally the condition we are in. In other words, to say yes. And to notice again how difficult that is. There's always something about it we don't really like. I remember lying awake when I was a young kid, and just becoming aware that I was never really content. That however much I'd got what I wanted, etc., there was always some nagging disquiet in some corner of my mind, something that was not quite right. And even if things did sort of work out well for a while, you kind of also knew that it wasn't ever going to last. And we resist that. We're kind of in a constant aversive relationship to life. So rather than embracing and saying yes in a really heartfelt and radical way, and in this sense in an unconditional way, that's the foundation of the practice, really. That's where the whole Buddhist path, in a sense, begins and ends, I feel. And I feel that once we start unpacking this sentence, we'll find that I feel this is basically what the text is saying. Okay? But we're still a little way off from being able to make sense of this passage. I think by now we've got an idea that it's not as though the unconditioned exists in some place outside the conditioned world. And if we get there, we've escaped from it. But going back to your point this morning about deliverance, I think we really need to get a better handle on what is going on there. Okay, now I'm going to read another translation of the same passage. This time by I.B. Horner. I.B. Horner was an English woman. She worked in the 1940s and 50s. She was the foremost Pali scholar of her day in the Pali Text Society. Many of her translations are still the Pali Text Society edition translations. I like her work. I like her choice of terms. And this is her translation of exactly the same passage. Now listen carefully. There is, monks, an unborn, not become, not made, unconditioned. And were it not, monks, for this unborn, not become, not made, unconditioned, no escape could be shown here. For what is born, has become, is made, and is conditioned. But because there is, monks, an unborn, not become, not made, unconditioned, therefore an escape can be shown for what is born, has become, is made, is conditioned. Did you spot the crucial difference? The crucial difference lies in the fact that instead of saying, if we read Morris's translation, then there would be no deliverance visible here for what is born, for what is become, made, conditioned, not from. Now you might say, well, that's a typical sort of scholarly distinction. I think it completely changes the meaning of the text. Okay? It's not that we're gaining deliverance or escape from the conditioned, but deliverance or escape is possible for those who are conditioned. Okay? It's a totally different idea. It's not escape from the conditioned, but escape for those who are conditioned. Now, Horn is the only one of the many translators who've worked on this passage to translate it that way. And when I first read her translation, I didn't even notice that difference. She doesn't point it out. And suddenly, I went, oh wow, she's doing something quite different.
In Pali, how...
Okay, so...
How can four be mistaken?
Ah, it can't. It shouldn't be. Because Pali, as I said earlier on, we did our Amoha Masa Mat stuff. And you have very clear declensions, as you do in Latin, and it should therefore be entirely evident whether the text says from the conditioned or for the conditioned. It's not the sort of thing you can mistake. But so what does Mr. Batchelor do? Mr. Batchelor goes back to the Pali, looks up the grammatical endings, and finds that Miss Horner is totally right. Now, you look at the modern translations of this in, say, Bhikkhu Bodhi, you'll get from the conditioned, escape from. As soon as you choose to translate Nisaranang as escape or deliverance, you have to say from, right? Well, she says escape for. I would drop escape and deliverance and translate it as emancipation. In other words, because, and now we're going to get close now to what I think this text means. Because it is because one can be unconditioned by greed and hatred and delusion, therefore it is possible in this world to be therefore it is possible for those who are conditioned to be emancipated from greed and hatred and delusion. We'll come back to that. I want to do another little detour before we get there. And that is to... it's very clear. It's sankhasa, which is of the conditioned. Asa is the common Pali genitive case, which means of, right? Not from. Now, what is going on here? And again, we might start finding this a little bit unsettling. Because what that translation shows is the orthodox Theravada belief. In other words, although the scholars know that it's an of, not a from, orthodoxy requires them to believe that the unconditioned is escape from the conditioned world. And that's basically the goal of all Indian religious tradition. Whether you're a Hindu or a Jain or a Buddhist, the goal of your practice is to achieve liberation from the cycle of birth and death. In other words, from the conditioned world itself. So this is understood as escape from the world. And that shows the degree to which Buddhism, Indian Orthodox Buddhism and later Buddhisms, are rooted in the Indian renunciant tradition. That's the goal of the Indian renunciant tradition, is to break free from ever having to be born again. And in that sense, you attain nibbana, which means the burning out of, or the exhaustion or the extinguishing of greed and hatred and delusion. Let me just look at another passage now where, you see, what's amazing now is that even if you're a lousy Pali scholar like me, and I mean that, I'm not a good Pali scholar at all. I don't have anything like the knowledge of Pali of these translators. I'm a complete amateur. So again, caveat emptor, beware. But I can tell a genitive from an ablative. It's pretty obvious. You don't have to be a expert philologist. What you can do now, because the whole Pali canon is online, you can do just a search. You can just put in Sankhasa and see what comes up. That's how I found out about these synonyms. I just put in Ragakayo, Dosakayo, ending of hatred, ending of desire, ending of delusion. I put that in the search engine on the online Pali canon, and it, 10 seconds later, I had every instance in the Pali canon where this phrase occurs. So you can, with a not particularly great mastery of this language, you can, with modern tools, you can learn really quite a lot. Now, one of the passages that I, while I was doing this research, I came across another passage in which this word nisaranang, escape, deliverance, what the hell is it? Escape, deliverance, or emancipation is found. And let me just read you that passage. And here I think this confirms my reading of the genitive case quite clearly. This is also in the Samyutta Nikaya. Most of the passages I'm quoting are from the Samyutta Nikaya. While I was still a bodhisattva, the Buddha recalls, it occurred to me, what is the delight of life? What is the tragedy of life? What is the emancipation of life? Same word, emancipation of life. And then, monks, it occurred to me, the happiness and joy that arise conditioned by life, that is the delight of life. That life is impermanent, dukkha, and changing, that is the tragedy of life. The removal and abandonment of grasping for life, that is the emancipation of life. Now, in the translation you'll read in the Wisdom Edition, it says, that is the escape from life. Now, I find this odd. I've chosen to use the English word life. Now, there is actually no exact Pali equivalent for that word. The text itself, in the rather repetitive manner of the suttas, goes through all of the things that were included in the passage you read out this morning about the all. What is the delight of the I? What is the tragedy of the I? What is the emancipation of the I? What is the delight of form? What is the tragedy of form? What is the emancipation of form? And this just goes on, two or three pages. And the chances are you'll say, why all of this fuss? And you kind of miss the point. Now, I'm choosing to translate eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, idea, or dhamma, simply as life. Or we could translate it as experience, which the Buddha considers to be the totality of, well, the all, the sabba, everything. So I've taken some liberation with the text, but instead of going through each of the sense doors, each of the sense objects, and just taking it as shorthand, using the shorthand term life or experience, this is what comes out. Now it's quite clear that what is the delight of life, the tragedy of life, the emancipation of life. If you look at, as I said, if you look in the translations in English, it'll say, what is the delight of life? What is the tragedy of life? What is the emancipation from life? But in fact, all of these terms, eye, sight, ear, sound, or what I've called life, are all in the genitive case. They're all asa, of. And here it becomes even further. This point I think is even further shown to be, I think, the correct interpretation, because it says, what is the emancipation of life? It is the removal and abandonment of grasping for life. In other words, it's emancipation from grasping, chandaraga, which is more or less equivalent to attachment or greed or thirst. So this passage, I feel, I think gives good justification for I.B. Horner's choice of the word for rather than from. In other words, it's not escape from the conditioned, it's emancipation for the conditioned. And the conditioned is us, people, you and me. We are born, made, become, and conditioned by, very often, you know, greed and hatred and so on. So if we look at it this way, the whole tone and meaning of this text begins to change. And this leads me at last to my own somewhat paraphrased version of the text. And this is what I would this would be how I would render it. It is possible to be unconditioned by desire, hatred, and delusion. Were this not possible, emancipation here for those who are conditioned by desire, hatred, and delusion would not be intelligible. But since it is possible to be unconditioned by desire, hatred, and delusion, then emancipation of those who are conditioned by them is intelligible. Now, I've translated what he calls visible. I.B. Horner calls it, what does she say? She says shown. The word is it's panyeta, and it's connected to the word panya, which means wisdom, actually. But that it literally means something like knowing or understanding. Another translator translates it as discernible, but I would perhaps choose something like intelligible. In other words, emancipation, liberation, nibbana, is intelligible. It makes sense. It's discernible. It's possible because it's possible to be unconditioned by greed and hatred and delusion. That's what emancipation means. It means to be free from the power of those inclinations, those driving forces. Yeah, panyeta. Now, so what we end up with is a meaning that's really quite far removed from what's said here. Rather than positing the idea of some transcendent or absolute godlike reality that is beyond the world and we can get there if we attain nibbana, we actually have an account of what may be possible for us here and now in this very life. It is striking, and even Morris Walsh says visible here, ita in Pali. In other words, right here, that word tends to be forgotten, but he is talking about something that is possible here. In other words, here, in this room, now, it's possible to be free, to be emancipated from the power of these sankhara, these conditioning forces of attachment and so forth and so on. And that, therefore, is pointing to an experience that is available here and now. And that experience is of value because it allows us to live from another perspective. Rather than living our lives in a kind of knee-jerk, habitual, habit-driven way, you know, just pushed and pulled by our fears and our desires, we can live in a way in which we are not conditioned by those forces. It doesn't mean that they've vanished forever. The chances are they still will keep on, you know, plaguing us until we die. But freedom is about thinking and speaking and acting in a way that is not determined by those drives and forces. That's freedom. It's not a freedom that is a kind of mystical state that we gain in deep meditation, although that might be a part of it. But that only has value if it can open us up to another way of being here in this world, responding to the suffering of this world. Now, the framework for that larger picture is, I would argue, the Four Noble Truths. And that's what we're going to look at tomorrow when we look at a secular Buddhism. I'm going to try and articulate in the framework of the Four Truths, which, as you've already pointed out, I'm going to question anyway, that it's anything to do with truth. That's another matter. But what I think this teaching and this practice is about living differently, living in a radically other way here and now in response to this only world we know for sure exists. The suffering, the pain, the various other disasters that we're constantly facing at all levels of our life. So in other words, leaving behind the metaphysics of Indian soteriology, Indian religious thought. And I do feel that that's what the Buddha may well have been doing, was to find a way to live unconditioned in a sense by classical Indian metaphysics about escaping the cycle of birth and death and all those things. Now, Buddhism clearly, over its history in India, returned to the matrix of Indian thought. It never managed to get out of it, just in the same way that it never managed to abolish the caste system. And I don't think these two things are at all different. I think the failure of the Buddhist social vision to the Buddha's vision of a classless society, as we know today, if you go to India, it just didn't happen. And I think Buddhism failed in India as a religious movement, not because the nasty Muslims came and burnt down the monasteries, although that didn't help, but because Buddhism, in a sense, over the centuries, compromised itself too greatly by returning to the framework of classical Vedic and Upanishadic thought to the point where it became more or less indistinguishable from Hinduism. And again, that's not my own theory, that's a largely accepted view now by historians. Now, this still leaves us with, I think, a rather important question that I haven't answered. Well, if what the Buddha meant is what I've just spent nearly 2 hours trying to explain to you, why didn't he say so? Why did he utter this really complicated text that it now takes a lot of analysis of Pali technical terms and genitives and ablatives to figure out? You know, why wasn't he just a little bit more, you know, straightforward? That's an important question, right? Now, of course, one way I could have got round that problem is by saying, well, actually, this must have been a passage that was added later. That's the standard way of sort of resolving those problems. Well, the Buddha didn't really say it. Some ex-Brahmin monk plugged it in later. But I don't believe that. Or at least I don't think we have to look at it that way. What this raises, I think, is an even more important issue. And that is, these teachings were always taught in contexts of actual living people. The Buddha was very much like Socrates. The Buddha taught dialogically. He spoke to people who asked him questions, as a rule. And he never wrote anything down. Nobody ever wrote anything down. I don't think he was interested in coming up with a kind of, you know, all-embracing, definitive philosophical account of the nature of reality. But he was interested in getting people to live differently. And I think that's clear from a lot of statements where he says, what I teach is dukkha, and it's usually translated as the end of dukkha, but I think it probably means the ending of craving. That's what he's about. He's pragmatic, he's therapeutic in his teachings, he wants to, in a sense, resolve the conflicts that bedevil us and confuse us and offer us a way of life in which we can respond more appropriately and wisely and compassionately to the suffering of the world. And I don't think that's a terribly radical thing to say. But if we accept that, we have to acknowledge that whatever he says cannot be just stripped out of context and just written on a page or on a whiteboard in this case, and the meaning of it will therefore then somehow be self-evident. You see, I think what's happened is that for many of the interpreters, like Maurice Walshaw and others, is they've just assumed that this is some factual statement about the nature of things. But let's imagine that it's not. Let's imagine that it might be spoken in, let's say, an ironic voice or a parodic voice. We don't know. When you go to the actual texts themselves, in other words, the Uddana 8.3 and the Itivuttaka 43, it gives a context, but a very minimalist context. In the Uddana it says, thus I have heard, at one time the Buddha was staying near Sarvati in the Jeta Wood at Anuttapindika's monastery. On that occasion he was instructing, rousing, inspiring and gladdening the monks with a Dharma talk concerning Nibbana. And those monks, being receptive and attentive and concentrating the whole mind, were intent on listening to the Dhamma. Then, on realizing its significance, he made this inspired utterance. Let me get that. End of discourse. Okay, so all it really says, and in a way the preamble is like a sort of seal of approval, really, sort of imprimatur. He was in the Jetta's Grove at Sarvati, where most of the discourses are given. He was talking to the monks about nirvana, which, again, is a synonym for the unconditioned. So, again, not a big surprise. Then he said this. That's all we know. In the Itivuttaka, the other occasion in the canon where this passage occurs, all it says is, this was said by the Lord, by the Arhant, this is what I heard. That's it. So no context. Now, all we do know, and if we can trust these preambles, is that he was giving a talk. But that again is suggested, because this wasn't the whole talk. This was just one element that was remembered from that talk. So what we have to try and do, what I feel I have to do, is to try to imagine a circumstance where he might have said something like this. Okay, I'm going to give you an example, and I'm going to give you an example that I'm taking from another sutta. This is Majjhima 38, which is the Maha. I'm afraid my printer hasn't done it properly. I'm not quite sure what it's called. Anyway, it's Majjhima 38, the 38th middle-length discourses, and it concerns a monk called Sati, the fisherman's son. And Sati, he's a monk, he's a bhikkhu, he's going around, he's teaching the Dhamma. But it comes to the Buddha's attention that Sati is going around saying that consciousness is unconditioned. Right? So he's like the headmaster in the study, says, I'd like to see Sati, tell him to come to my office. So Sati comes to the Gandakuti, and the Buddha says, is this true? You're teaching that the consciousness is unconditioned? And Sati says, yes, of course it is. And then the Buddha says, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma in that way? Misguided man, he says, you fool. In many discourses, have I not stated consciousness to arise upon conditions, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness? Which again comes back to what I was saying earlier this morning, and this is a very clear example of that. The Buddha is actually saying, look, consciousness arises out of conditions just like anything else. And he gives an example. He says, just as we call a grass, if a fire depends upon grass, we call it a grass fire. If a fire depends upon dung, we call it a dung fire. If consciousness depends upon the eyes, we call it visual consciousness. If consciousness depends upon the ears, we call it auditory consciousness. It's contingent upon the circumstances out of which it arises. It's not unconditioned. Now, I think this must have been a problem, probably a repeated problem at the Buddha's time, especially amongst those monks who came from a Brahmanical background, that they just couldn't quite get the idea that consciousness, which remember in the Upanishads is very often identified with Atman, the soul, or with Brahman, God, divine intelligence, or something like that, it's very difficult to somehow unlearn that idea. And I suspect that this discourse with Sati, where the Buddha hauls him up and says, look, that's not what I'm teaching, was probably included in the canon precisely in order to remind the monks that consciousness is as conditioned as anything else. So the Buddha wouldn't have been, as a Sati, wouldn't have been alone in this. I suspect there were many monks who, even at the Buddha's time, slipped into that kind of speech. So I can imagine a situation where the Buddha's giving a talk and he's telling the monks that there is nothing beyond the domain of our changing, tragic and conditioned experience, what he calls the all. And you can imagine a monk who would say, but sir, surely there is the unconditioned. For if there were not this unconditioned, how would emancipation from what is conditioned be possible here? And in reply, the Buddha, realizing the significance of the way the question was phrased, would, perhaps with an ironic smile, say, indeed, friend, there is an unconditioned. For if there were not an unconditioned, emancipation for the conditioned would not be intelligible here. Why? And I'm making this up, by the way. This is my hypothetical scenario. Why? Because in this Dhamma, one can be unconditioned by desire, unconditioned by hatred, unconditioned by confusion. Therefore, emancipation for those who are conditioned by desire and hatred or confusion is possible in this life. So that's a hypothesis. We cannot know whether that was the case. But given other passages, this seems an entirely plausible account for why the Buddha would have said that, saying it basically as a riposte to monks who were still somehow attached to the idea of Brahman or unconditioned consciousness, and saying, look, of course there's an unconditioned, surely there is. And the Buddha would say, yes. Again, this is his strategy, not to reject these ideas, but to reinterpret them. Yes, there is, friend, an unconditioned, but it's not what you think it is. It's to be unconditioned by greed and hatred and so on. And so we could argue, I would argue, that this passage is actually a very good example of the Buddha's skill in teaching. And possibly because the monks found it so sort of sharp and witty and intelligent, they memorized that passage as a kind of in-joke. And then later, as over the centuries these memorized texts were collated, the context was forgotten, and this was remembered in isolation. And finally, it ended up in two collections, the Udana and the Itivutaka, which have come down to us today. So, that is admittedly speculative, but it persuades me. But then it would, wouldn't it? But nonetheless, I mean, whether you accept that argument or not, I think, you know, a reflection on this passage, once you start probing it, once you start digging into it, you find that it's not what the apparent face value very quickly breaks down, and we're left with I think quite a conundrum, quite a puzzle that I've sought to answer and unravel in this essay. So as I said before, I'm willing to make this available to you. And you can read the thing in more detail. There's a lot more arguments and passages quoted as well. But let's stop here now for tea. It's 3:30. And we'll meet back here in 20 minutes. We'll have another sitting, and then we'll open up for a final conclusion.